You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of June, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with Dr. James Boyes from King's College London. James, what do you have for us?
Well, as Barack Obama turns bounty hunter in Africa, we consider the Bradley Manning trial and ask whether Obama will avoid the same fate as Richard Nixon.
Plus, we've been heading to the skies in record numbers as airlines expect bumper profits, but we find out what, yet untapped market, everyone wants a piece of.
Art lovers have been strolling along the canals in Venice, taking in the Biennale. We're there to tell you what you might have missed.
The national pavilions have no overriding theme, but a few trends emerge. Issues of money, nature, process, or simply art's formal aspects.
And we visit Ghana to find out why modernism plays a role in post-colonial societies.
Amartya Fayoum points out relics of tropical modernism as we drive through Accra. We pass the Museum of Science and Technology, which he says was built by Polish architects during Nkrumah's precarious engagement with the Soviet Union.
Not only those tasty morsels, we'll also play some music too. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So, lots to look forward to in the next 59-odd minutes. But before all that, here is Bill Bingham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Turkish opposition leaders say a 22-year-old member of a political youth party has died after being shot during anti-government protests. They say the man was seriously injured during clashes in southern Turkey. His death, which hasn't been officially confirmed by the government, follows that of a 20-year-old man in Istanbul. Turkey's 250,000 public sector workers begin a two-day strike today in protest of what they've condemned as state terror against the demonstrations. The strike's expected to affect schools, universities and public offices throughout the country. River levels in the Czech Republic have risen sharply overnight after the authorities were forced to open several dams in the south. Levels on the river Vltava, which flows through the capital, are expected to peak later today. Severe floods caused by days of heavy rain have left at least seven people dead in the Czech Republic and two others in neighbouring Austria. Germany has drafted in its army to help reinforce flood defences in the south. In the town of Passau in Bavaria, floodwaters have now reached a level not seen since the 16th century. US experts say North Korea is making important progress on reactivating facilities at its mothballed Yongbyon nuclear reactor. Startup is thought to be 1 to 2 months away, but there's uncertainty over the availability of fuel rods. North Korea announced in April that it planned to reactivate the plant amid high tension on the Korean Peninsula. It was closed in 2007 as part of a disarmament for aid deal. The United States says it's sending a Patriot missile battery and F-16 fighters to Jordan for military exercises. Officials say the armaments may be kept there to help deal with threats from the conflict in Syria. The announcement comes amid diplomatic efforts led by the United States and Russia to organise peace talks later this month. Friends and teammates have been speaking of their support for the athlete Oscar Pistorius as he prepares for his court appearance today. The Olympic and Paralympic star shot his girlfriend, the model Reva Steenkamp, on the 14th of February. He's admitted shooting her four times through a locked door, but he says he was acting in self-defence in what he thought was an intruder. Prosecutors are accusing him of premeditated murder. His uncle, Arnold Pistorius, says he's under pressure.
He's battling, but with a family behind him, it's with his sister living in the same house as he lives at MA, and they assist him a lot, and we are preparing him. He will definitely be ready. Being the mind that he is, being the man that he is, he will know what it's going to take.
Beijing tightened its security on Monday on the anniversary of China's crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators around Tiananmen Square. Police cars have been parked around Chang'an Avenue near the square, one of the most recognisable landmarks in China, where tanks rolled through 24 years ago. Memorials and protests are held in Hong Kong every year to mark the anniversary of the incident. These young Hong Kong residents understand what the protests and their suppression mean.
I think China need a long time to build up the democracy. And this anniversary is remind all of us to help China to build up the democracy.
I think it is just because so many people died and like it was such a historical event in China. Like, and I mean, we're a part of it. So I think, yeah, it's quite a big event.
Bollywood actress Jia Khan has been found dead at her home in the Indian city of Mumbai. Police haven't said how she died, but they're seeking information from her neighbours. The 25-year-old actress made her debut in 2007 opposite Amitabh Bachchan and went on to act with stars including Aamir Khan and Akshay Kumar. Jia Khan was born in New York and grew up in London before moving to Mumbai to start her Bollywood career. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Mr. Bill Bingham there. Thank you very much, Bill. He will be back in half an hour with slightly shorter headlines at the bottom of the hour. 6 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Hong Kong, Zurich, London, Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. To buy Monocle, that is it.
From London,
London, London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It's now time for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Dr. James Boyce from King's College London, a regular to this program and a good friend to all of us here on Monocle 24. James, let's begin with a trial that many describing as the trial of the decade, Bradley Manning.
Yeah, indeed. We all seem to have a trial of the century, a trial of the decade, I guess. And surprise, surprise. Prize, it's Bradley Manning. Now, of course, as all your listeners will know, this is the chap who's been basically brought to trial for leaking material to WikiLeaks. So we've got Bradley Manning on trial in the US. We've got Julian Assange held up somewhere at the Ecuadorian embassy, I think, here in London. So all concerned are now very much being banged to rights. And of course, it's a great debate about, you know, the rights, the wrongs, the ins and the outs about whether this should be happening at all. And I guess we're going to be seeing an awful lot play out in the next sort of couple of weeks as Manning goes on trial, having already been in custody, of course, for the best part of 3 years already. So a great debate, I think, coming up about where this is going to go.
And he's admitted everything except this one charge. It's aiding the enemy, isn't it? This is the sort of slightly unusual charge. It's not one that comes up very often that he's denied. And how's this, this is a debate, how's it going in the US? How's this, it's presumably pretty polarised.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's definitely polarising opinion, not only in the US, but arguably around the world, I think. It's really making people think, well, okay, you know, what's the remit here? Where's the line lay between private and public responsibility, between, you know, where your responsibilities lie? If you sign up as a soldier, are you meant to salute the flag, follow orders, or do you have a moral responsibility to release this sort of information? And that's basically his line. Others will take a different point of view entirely. And I think one of the great problems here is, of course, America, you know, has this great idea of putting itself forward as a bastion of democracy, but then it does dark things like keeps this guy incarcerated for 3 years in what are accepted to be rather inconvenient conditions for him, and then brings him to trial and then talks about democracy and God and value and the flag. And I think if it didn't hoist itself on its own petard so much, it would be in a much stronger position morally and ethically and legally.
And during opening arguments, the prosecution made quite a case, pointing out his relationship with Julian Assange, saying that he actually worked with Julian Assange to pick and choose bits of information to publish on WikiLeaks. What factor will that play with the judge?
Well, I think one of the problems you got here is because you've got this relationship between a member of the armed forces and Julian Assange, who I don't think is going to go down in anybody's books as the most popular individual, especially in the United States at this point, you're going to see this idea that, you know, this is about a relationship designed to embarrass and bring out the worst, and not this idea of, well, there was a moral responsibility. I think it cuts to the heart of Bradley Manning's defence, arguably. And as a result of that, I think it could seriously undermine him, importantly in the role of public opinion.
Do you think the defence will, though, argue that he was in some ways manipulated by Julian Assange? Because one area that he is using for his defence, Bradley Manning is saying that he was bullied in the army, he was tormented in the army, and that's one of the reasons why he did this. Do you think they'll be able to use the defence that he was perhaps manipulated by Julian Assange in any particular order?
It's not impossible, but one wonders, therefore, how that relationship came about in the first place and was developed. One wonders also about the how appropriate it was that this chap was in the army in the first place. It sounds like he was ill at ease and ill, perhaps not in the best of environments. I think that what you're going to see is a lot of people are trying to sort of draw parallels here with what Daniel Ellsberg did with the Pentagon Papers in the 1970s. That, of course, was a view that went back and looked at what had happened in Vietnam, and it was a report that basically went over old ground. The problem you've got here is you've got the leaks of ongoing operational documentation about events that are going on in field. And I think this is the great problem, is it's ultimately a breach of national security. Whether one agrees or disagrees with the moral perspective, it's definitely put operations at risk.
And precedent is presumably a very big thing in this point in the evolution of what might be possible for leaking documents in future. They certainly will want this to go one way. I want to move on, sure, if we can, because there are lots of cries for impeach Obama from various different sources around the US. Who's been shouting it loudest, do you think?
Well, I remember Phil shouting it last week when we were talking about this.
I wasn't shouting for his impeachment. I was just saying that was an option people are talking about.
I heard shockwaves went around the Oval
Office. Absolutely.
Mr. Phil Hahn,
absolutely.
Okay, but not just Phil, others
but
apparently.
Not just Phil. It's being discussed openly in the United States now. And this, of course, is because of the link with the IRS scandal, as well as other issues to do with the going after of people who work for AP, for example. This idea that we're now openly drawing a parallel between Nixon and Obama, and it's incredible. I mean, I wrote a paper about this 18 months ago, talking about Nixon and Obama as a comparable, and people looked at me like, what? How on earth? It's Obama and Kennedy. You've mixed it up. And I was like, no. Let's look at this and go through this. And it's fascinating now that 18 months later on, it seems to be hitting the mainstream. So I'm quite pleased about that.
Yeah, you should be. What were the main points of comparison for you, briefly?
I was looking briefly at this idea that Obama and Nixon had both used what I called inherited wars of choice, i.e. Iraq and Vietnam, to gain political office in 68 and 2008, about how they used their inherited wars of choices against their political opponents, manipulated the events, and then used them throughout their first term in office to get re-elected. In this case, of course, now the suggestion is Obama, like Nixon, has some sort of an enemies list in this case being people of the right. Very interesting piece Peggy Nunez put together this morning, Wall Street Journal, saying that the difference between Watergate and this, however, is that with Watergate, Nixon was going after his political opponents who are professionals, and in this case, it's almost worse because Obama's and the IRS are going after individuals and private citizens, arguably, who were not political professionals.
Do you think the right perhaps is trying to capitalize a bit too much on his scandals that may not necessarily resonate with the American public? I just want to give you one poll. A poll, his approval rating from April was 51%, rather, and his poll just taken this week was 53%. So he actually had an increase in his approval rating.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? What's that line? Lies, damn lies and statistics. I looked at another poll this morning that showed his disapproval ratings had gone up to 52%. So
let's have a poll off.
Yeah, poll off.
Very briefly move on to the last one, which is Obama and a bounty on African terrorists. What's this about?
Absolutely. I was bizarre. This was this idea that if you think America is engaged in Afghanistan, which is next, well, apparently now it's getting involved in Africa as well. Not only is basing drones out of there, but it's posted a $23 million reward to track down five leaders of armed groups in West Africa. So this idea now that Obama and the United States are turning bounty hunter in Africa, it's quite a clever way about doing this, I think. Perhaps one could disagree with the idea of having bounties, but it's a much cheaper way of doing this than going in and sending the full Marines and a detachment in, effectively. And I always wondered why they didn't do this more systematically and cleverly, perhaps, after 9/11. Just basically say, look, we're going to put a huge bounty on the heads of these people, turn them in, you know, and
reduce the expenditure. But they did have bounties on some of, you know, the most well-known terrorists, but they never caught any of them.
Sure, one wonders where they put enough of a bounty on. Perhaps if you make it so it's almost like impossible possible not to turn these people in. But certainly it would have been cheaper in the long run, I think, than what ended up taking over a decade to get to effect.
Dr. James Boyes from King's College London, thank you very much, as ever, for helping us set today's agenda.
And coming up after this break, we'll talk aviation and find out why your flight has been so full lately.
North to south, east to west, next week on Monocle 24, we're in the Americas and swinging in all directions.
We kick off on Tuesday in Sao Paulo, where we'll be covering the new city summit over 2 days and talking to the mayors, architects, policymakers and planners shaping the world's biggest, most complex cities. Join me, Andrew Tuck and our correspondents for a special edition of The Globalist Asia at 7 a.m. Auckland time, 2100 hours in London and 1500 hours in New York, before we jump over the equator and connect with Tyler Bray and Tom Edwards, who'll be travelling down the West Coast.
From Wednesday, we'll be anchoring the Monocle Daily live from Vancouver, Seattle and Portland and talking to the people shaping these cities in business, politics, media and the arts. Along the way, we'll also be meeting our readers and listeners at a series of special events and checking in with our correspondents throughout the Pacific Northwest.
That's The Globalist Asia from Sao Paulo on Tuesday and Wednesday.
And The Monocle Daily from Vancouver, Seattle and Portland from Wednesday to Friday.
Right here across the Americas and around the world on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, if you've been on a flight in the last 3 months, you'll probably have noticed that there's barely a free seat in sight. Airline loans have been near capacity and flights have been so full that the International Air Transport Association announced that earnings forecasts will be 20% higher than they were just 3 months ago.
Yes, during the annual IATA meeting, the industry group said that airlines would carry more than 3 billion people, the first time in history, indeed. US airlines are expected to do very well, giving them a chance against profitable Asian and Middle Eastern carriers. Africa, however, remains the poorest performing region, but there are big hopes that that could change. That's what we're going to talk about now. Joining us on the line is Dan Michaels, aviation reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Dan, welcome to Midori House. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Indeed, nice to have you here. Give us a picture, if you can, of the African aviation industry at the moment. We'll all be familiar with some of the bigger carriers. They're getting bigger, and other smaller carriers are joining in, aren't they?
Indeed, for many years, African aviation was a pretty sad story. Most African countries couldn't pull together a substantial airline. And it was dominated by European airlines from the former colonial powers. In Africa, it was mainly South African Airways. Some of the North African countries like Morocco and Egypt had halfway decent airlines, good airlines. But more recently, with the boom in commodities in Africa, agriculture, and the sort of fitful Africa renaissance, you're starting to see some industry developing. The world is discovering Africa, and they need airplanes to get there. So Africa is becoming one of the fastest-growing aviation markets, although from a very low base.
But they do still have a lot of hurdles that they'll need to get over. Namely, infrastructure is a big issue. Plus, African airlines still have a very poor reputation when it comes to safety as well.
Exactly. Africa, about 8 years ago, 10 years ago, accounted for less than 4% of world air traffic and about 25% of fatal accidents. It was a real mess. It's gotten a lot better. The safety of African airlines has improved significantly, though there's still a long way to go. The sort of culture of safety is just not something that permeates Africa or a lot of other places around the world. People just being aware of when something might be dangerous. So it's something that will come with time. People are working on it. And the African airlines are starting to invest. They're buying new planes. Ethiopian and Kenya Airways are among the first buyers of Boeing's new 787 Dreamliner, the high-tech plane that's had a lot of troubles but now seems to be back in service. And Ethiopian was one of the first to fly it.
Now, I wonder if Africa starts to gain, if Africa's airline industry starts to win, who starts to lose? Will that damage the Asian carriers? Will it damage the European market?
The people with the most to lose right now are the Europeans. Airlines like Air France and British Airways who have roots to their former colonies, mainly in Africa, that have been very profitable because there's been no local competition. When European airlines fly to the U.S., for example, they have competition from the U.S. airlines, or Asia, competition from the Asian airlines. But in Africa, the African airlines just haven't been there. So it's been most routes to Africa have been almost monopolies for the airlines, and airlines like nothing better than a monopoly because then they can charge whatever they want.
And that's
starting to change.
And let's move now from the full-service carriers to airlines, to budget airlines. FastJet, which was launched a couple years back, was the brainchild of the EasyJet founder. Do budget airlines have a real shot of growth here as well? And I'm talking about African budget airlines.
Yeah, there are efforts to do it, but it's going to be hard because, as you mentioned earlier, the infrastructure just isn't there. Most African airports don't even come close to what most Europeans or Americans or Asians think of as an airport. There's a runway and some shack of a building, so it's improving. But low-cost airlines in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia have benefited from the fact that main airports, big city airports, are full, and so they're using secondary airports further out of town, and there's almost an arbitrage there playing off the congestion of the traditional airlines. You don't have that in Africa. The air traffic isn't developed. So finding a way to undercut the big guys, it is just not that much opportunity to undercut them. What there is an opportunity to do is to run sort of bare bones intra-Africa traffic, and that's really what's starting to happen. The other factor you have is the Gulf carriers, Persian Gulf carriers like Emirates and Etihad and Qatar, starting to push into Africa in a big way. And that competition is just driving the price down for everybody.
The IATA Director General said at this year's gathering that nowhere is the potential for aviation greater than on that continent, the home to a billion people spread across 20% of the world's landmass. When you hear it put in those sorts of stats, it really makes sense, doesn't it? And what should we take from the fact that Cape Town was the host city for the conference this time?
It is a clear signal that Africa is one of the few markets in the world that has just almost unlimited growth potential because roads in Africa are substandard or non-existent in most places. Distances, as you mentioned, are just huge. And some parts of Africa, the Sahara, some of the mountains, the jungles are just incredibly difficult to cross on the ground. So aviation really is the way to get around Africa. But it's starting, again, from a very minimal level. So the potential is there, but the resources that will need to go in it to develop it are also enormous.
Excellent stuff. Dan Michaels, aviation reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Many thanks for your time. Now, every 2 years, the super rich descend on Venice by the way of their super yachts. I never got an invitation this year.
No, really?
That's quite disappointing.
Shucks.
I asked on air a few days ago, but no RSVP.
You just use this as a sort of
a launchpad to parties.
Yeah, impeaching Obama and trying to get on a yacht. Your two quests for today. Good luck with that.
Well, the super rich are joined by curators, artists, museum directors, and auction house experts to see and to be seen and to take the temperature of contemporary art today.
Yes, the Venice Biennale opened to the public last Saturday. The Encyclopedic Palace is the title its curator Massimiliano Gioni has decided on. And 88 countries are exhibiting, amongst them 10 first-timers, including Kosovo and Kuwait, no less. And beyond the things Venice veterans will be familiar with, parties, glamour and very long queues, there have been some surprises too. Our roving arts reporter Kimberly Bradley intermingled amongst the stars. In case you missed her report on last night's culture show, here's a bit of what she experienced.
On the second preview day, rain falls on the pebbles of the Giardini, the gardens where many of the 88 historical national pavilions sit. Long queues form at the British Pavilion, where Jeremy Deller takes a cynical look at Britain, as well as at the German and French pavilions, which traded buildings this year. The national pavilions have no overriding theme, but a few trends emerge. Issues of money, nature, process, or simply art's formal aspects. Swiss Pavilion curator Giovanni Carmine explains the spare metal sculptures, including flattened musical instruments and a long winding metal snake, by artist Valentin Caron.
Formally, it's really
very straightforward. It was making no much compromises, and so I think the message is very clear. And inside is this huge carnival, which is the biennial. To have a position which is that clear, I think it's a very good idea.
Well, Kimberly Bradley was in a snippet there, and she will be with us now, I hope. Kimberly joins us on the line. Kimberly, how are you?
I'm good.
Excellent.
I'm tired.
Good. Well, what? Tell us, what have you been excited about? What have been the things that are still spinning around in your head when you wake up in the morning?
Beyond the things that seem to be the perennial favorites, like the British Pavilion, are a few things that were a bit off the beaten path, like the Romanian Pavilion, which was a huge favorite, but it was really, really spare. It was done by two choreographers. Let me look at their names. Alexander Perici and Manuel Penlos. And what they did is they got a team of about six dancers to reenact some of the best biennial pavilions over the past 50 years. So they'd announce which work they were pretending to be, and they would act it out. And I saw Guernica by Picasso, and they each took the form of one of the figures in the painting. It was absolutely fantastic. You could sit in there for 2 hours and watch them. But it was also very low budget. It was just the dancers and a few plywood benches. That's it.
That's very interesting. There are something like 88 countries participating in this year's Biennale. Was there a theme that was perhaps running through some of these exhibitions?
Each pavilion or each country has its own thing that it can feature, and so there's no overriding theme that's prescribed, but things that I noticed that were coming up again and again were issues of money. Like the Greek pavilion, the artist looked at every single kind of currency that exists in the world and had three films running about the Greek situation. The Russian pavilion had golden coins falling from the ceiling, which you could put an umbrella over your head and miss. There were a lot of pieces that were they were riffing on the main show, which is called, again, the Encyclopedic Palace. And so different artists would have kind of long, you could see their work process. You could see multi-part works in different pavilions. Mark Manders in the Dutch pavilion had a whole series of all the works in his studio, things like that. It felt a lot less ostentatious than previous biennials.
I wonder, I've been reading about the Turkish Pavilion and what sort of happened to it as back home in Turkey, the political situation became ever more combustible. Apparently, the Turkish Pavilion acted as a sort of demonstration point, a sort of proxy demonstration away from home. What do you know about that?
What was running in the pavilion were 13 films by a young Turkish artist named Ali Kazma. And once the things broke out in Turkey, it became a bit of an information point. The demonstrators actually went to Piazza San Marco. They were on the main piazza. And there was just solidarity from the arts community for the Turkish demonstrators. And it was really quite wonderful that this pavilion transformed into kind of an off-site support system. It was great.
Another artist, Ai Weiwei, who has been exhibiting with Germany, what's been the reaction like been to his work? Not so positive, generally, I understand.
You know what? I don't know, because the line to get into Germany was 2 hours long when I got there. People, I think, are having a little bit of Ai Weiwei saturation. He had three different shows in the biennial. And to be honest, it's just that people weren't talking about him so much. It wasn't necessarily negative. It just wasn't. He wasn't the main point of discussion, which tells you something, because usually he is.
Does it change the atmosphere, Kimberly? You talked about the fact that the Romanian sort of greatest hits choreographed installation was a sort of low budget thing, and that there are various different works about money. I mean, obviously there is an inherent contradiction in there being a sort of austerity Venice Biennale, of course. But I mean, was there any sense that the atmosphere has changed as well as the sort of topics that they're talking about because of economics?
I have to be honest, there's still incredible wealth that descends upon the city for this event, and there's tons of money spent on, I know, for example, the Austrian Pavilion was twice budget at 1 million euros. The Austrian government gives 400,000, things like that. There were things that were very expensive, but instead of the huge yachts that you saw 2 years ago, the yachts were a little smaller. They weren't meant to impress. People were just kind of looking at the work. Again, I can't say that it was austere because it never is, but it felt like it was a bit of a reality check for the art world. It was really nice to see, to be honest.
Interesting. Slightly smaller yachts then. That's the austerity Biennale. Maybe you've got more chance of getting on that one, Phil. Kimberly Bradley, thank you very much indeed.
Van uit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
Where are you, London? This is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we're going to head to Copenhagen to discover what's making the headlines there. We will review the British papers with Steve Bloomfield, and we will take a tour of Ghanaian architecture too. First, Bill Bingham, he's got your headlines.
Turkish opposition leaders say a 22-year-old member of a political youth party has died during anti-government protests. They say the man was seriously injured in gunfire during clashes in southern Turkey and died later in hospital. His death, which hasn't been officially confirmed by the government, follows that of a 20-year-old man in Istanbul. Turkey's 250,000 public sector workers begin a two-day strike today in protest at what they've condemned as state terror against the demonstrations. River levels in the Czech Republic have risen sharply overnight after the authorities were forced to open several dams in the south. Levels on the river Vltava, which flows through the capital, are expected to peak later today. Severe floods caused by days of heavy rain have left at least 7 people dead in the Czech Republic and 2 others in neighbouring Austria. US experts say North Korea is making important progress on reactivating facilities at its mothballed Yongbyon nuclear reactor. Startup is thought to be 1 to 2 months away, but there's uncertainty over the availability of fuel rods. The reactor was closed in 2007 as part of a disarmament for aid deal. The United States says it's sending a Patriot missile battery and F-16 fighters to Jordan for military exercises. Officials say the armaments may be kept there to help deal with threats from the conflict in Syria. The announcement comes amid diplomatic efforts led by the United States and Russia to organise peace talks later this month. The athlete Oscar Pistorius is preparing for his court appearance today. The Olympic and Paralympic star shot his girlfriend, the model Reva Steenkamp, on the 14th of February. He's admitted shooting her 4 times through a locked door, but he says he acted in self-defence at what he thought was an intruder. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and him, Phil Hahn.
It is indeed me. Architectural modernism and international style had a role to play in the aftermath of the Second World War. Cities needed a style that was functional and had clean lines at a time when the world was looking for a new direction after the destruction of war.
But modernism also had a role to play in post-colonial societies. New nations were emerging across Africa and Asia. Many sought to give their cities an identity that was visibly modern, but also free from the fetters of power expressed during colonial rule. For this week's Section D, Monocle's Accra correspondent Christopher Lord takes a look at the relics of this era of exchange in Ghana and assesses the condition of these buildings today.
When the Union Jack came down in Accra in 1957 to be replaced with the tropical tricolour flag of independent Ghana, the country's first president, Kwame Nkrumah, founded the country on an incurable taste for the modern. He wanted jazz or highlife bands to play the unofficial anthems of this new country. He sent young Ghanaians abroad to bring back the best technical and medical expertise that the West and Soviet Union could offer. And, most visibly, he invited a new wave of foreign architects to the country, who could express this free African nation in the clean and progressive lines of modernism. The buildings from this era of so-called tropical modernism remain around Accra, but without any push to protect and restore these buildings, many of them are looking a little worse for wear. Take the Children's Library, designed by Maxwell Fry, one of Britain's most important post-war architects. It may still be standing, but it's lacking books, going largely unused, and is in desperate need of a spruce-up. On the circular ramp at the entrance to the library, I meet Nat Amatefio, a former mayor of Accra and an architect who's currently writing a history of this city's buildings.
Max Fry was part of the first group of young architects who came to the colonies after the war to make a name for themselves. And he ended up being one of the a great inspiration for contemporary architecture, not only here in Ghana, but also in Nigeria. He was the archetypal colonial architect. The interesting thing is that he, in his way, rejected much of the vocabulary of colonial architecture and instituted in its place a very modernist outlook. This children's library opened in 1957, around the time of our independence. The walls are composed mainly of louvered glass windows. So it's always cool in here. There's always plenty of light. It's just about the best building that could ever be designed for young children with their short attention span and their need for movement.
Amartya Field points out relics of tropical modernism as we drive through Accra. We pass the Museum of Science and Technology, which he says was built by Polish architects during Nkrumah's precarious engagement with the Soviet Union. I've been inside that red-tiled museum. Today it's been gutted of its exhibits and is home to migrant workers from the north who carve masks for sale in tourist markets. We visit the now decommissioned American embassy, designed by Harry Weiss, a Californian. It is a masterpiece of levity, using concrete stilts, dark wood exterior, and an airy central courtyard to give the impression that the embassy is floating right next to the enclave, far removed
you have apples in
from
your
the current
time.
Fortress-like American embassy. We also passed the parliamentary building, designed by a group of Ghanaian architects to house the organization of the community. A recent Chinese-led refurb, however, has masked its clean modernist lines with a plastic facade.
So are you filling a gap that will one day be filled by a staff producer?
Amartya Field takes us to a residential project conceived in the 60s by Kenneth Scott that's still in use as it was originally intended, albeit in need of a little love. Scott's work can be found all over this city and typifies the tropical modernist aesthetic.
This complex is called Nkrumah Flats, named quite obviously after Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first president and founder of the country. And he had this place built for middle level as well as senior civil servants. It consists of about 4-6-story apartment buildings clad in black and white with all the vocabulary of the modernist tropical design. A lot of slats, openings in wall to allow for airflow, and louver windows all over. It's a bright and airy structure. What is fascinating about this particular area is it has retained its original design advantages. It's extremely green, full of birds. Unfortunately, it looks very disheveled and unkempt because it's not being maintained as it should. But it is one of the icons of the modernist movement in this city, and one that is still fully used, and that we hope when we be able to restore, we get funding and we get policies to restore buildings, we hope we'll be able to do something about maintaining these buildings as they were originally designed.
3 hours down the coast from Accra, I meet Joe Osei Addo. He trained at the Architectural Association in London in the 80s and established his practice in Los Angeles. But in 2004, he returned to Ghana to push what he calls an innovative style of building, how to interrogate contemporary problems with vernacular architectural thinking. He's currently championing a locally produced addition to cement that gives the final product some of the coolant properties of mud. Osei Addo has formed a coalition of architects, industrialists and concerned residents who are keen on safeguarding Accra's architectural heritage. They're beginning with Max Fry's Children's Library.
It's one step at a time. We're trying to bring back the original exhibition space back to its original use, restoring that, and then adding economic value to that by creating programming so people can use the space, actively use it, and pay for that, for its use. And this will be a way for the library itself to fund itself. You can preserve a building by creating opportunities from within where it can support itself. So it's a self-sustaining ecology, so to speak. That's what we have to kind of focus on in preservation rather than looking at the edifice.
This whole story of tropical modernism, it's so tied up with Nkrumah's story as well. And what I've noticed is that there's more and more exhibitions here at readdressing the life of Nkrumah. People have conversations and Nkrumah's on everybody's lips at the moment.
I think as we become an emerging economy with all these challenges, I think people are now being reminded how in just 9 years, this young man transformed not only a nation, but the continent. Architecture became just only one of many ways that he emphasized the role of the independent African. So it was not only architecture, it was in our music, in our literature, in our sculpture. He promoted all the arts because he knew that that was the DNA that he needed to kind of redevelop so that the African believes in themselves. So that you could imagine the Accra of the Six with all these new buildings coming up, all these new parks coming, all these new schools being built, new museums being built. I mean, that's powerful.
Ghana's economic emergence is written into its skyline. Cranes and candy-coloured luxurious high-rises now loom over the streets, and there's a proliferation of gated communities sporting wistful names and designs derived from European mansions. But there's also a growing urge in society to reconnect with those first years after independence. Of course, the modernist innovations in building for the climate should be acknowledged during Accra's current building boom. But there's a sense that Ghanaians want to reconnect with the time before the non-stop coups of the 70s and 80s, a time when the country was young, independence was in the air, and a global sharing of ideas was taking place that was in the true spirit of modernism. For Monocle, in Accra, I'm Christopher Lord.
And you can hear more design reports on tonight's edition of Section D at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with an update from Copenhagen on the latest news from Denmark.
The Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
...8:41 in London. That makes it 9:41 in Copenhagen, and that is the time that we are going to go to now. Michael Booth is our man in Copenhagen. Welcome, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Let's talk about the right-wing Danish People's Party, under attack, apparently.
Yeah, I love stories about the Danske Folkeparti, the Danish People's Party, cocking up, and they did massively last week. They ran full-page ads in some of the newspapers, at least the newspapers that accepted the ad, in which they listed by name almost 700 people who had recently been accepted as Danish residents, and said that one of these people is a terrorist, basically. One of the people on this list, we're not allowed to tell you which one, has been highlighted by the Danish security services as a threat to Denmark. But rather than name the person, they kind of implicated all 700 on the list of these people who were, I would imagine, overjoyed to finally have had their long and lengthy and difficult applications accepted to live in Denmark, and then they find themselves hung out to dry in national newspapers as a potential terrorist, including one of the people on the list was a two-year-old child.
Oh, it really is startling stuff there, Michael. What's been the reaction there in Denmark to this? And is the Danish People's Party, are they going to be penalised in some way for this?
There have been calls for legal action against them, and I believe some of the people on the list are taking legal action. The problem is, actually, this list has been public on a Danish ministry website. It's just the Danish People's Party took the step of actually taking full-page ads in some of the national newspapers. They believe that this information was out there in the public arena anyway, so it should have been made more widely available.
Extraordinary stuff. Let's talk about Danish laziness, if we can.
Not Michael's, though.
Not yours. You're a very, very sprightly person in Denmark, but apparently lots of people in Denmark aren't. Why are they so lazy?
Well, there have been several stories over the last few months about the big concern is Danish productivity levels, which aren't increasing and haven't been increasing for the last 10 years. There have been a few scandals about long-term benefit claimants. One guy who was on benefits for 11 years, yet perfectly able to work. He's now a celebrity in Denmark called Lazy Robert is his name. And the latest criticism comes from a director of Vestas, the world-famous windmill company, big corporation in Denmark. He also happens to be a professor of philosophy at the University of Aalborg, which is a strange mix. His name's Morten Aalbeck, and he's written a book basically slagging off the Danes as lazy and parochial and rather full of themselves and deluded. He says that they have a kind of X-factor culture now in Denmark where everyone believes they're something special and can achieve anything without really any productivity or effort. And he thinks Denmark is deluding itself, and he's kind of given the Danes a slap around the chops. Apparently, in 2012, the Danes believed they work 39 hours a week, but in reality, a recent survey has showed they only work 33 hours a week. And this guy, Morten Aalbeck, points out that's actually 11 days off a year that the Danes are deluding themselves about.
Well, that works for me. But obviously, the Danes are well known for their quality of life. Here at Monocle, they consistently rank near the top in terms of our quality of life index. Must be a bit of a balance then, work a couple less hours, but have a better style of life.
Yeah, I think it's the paradox of the Danish success, actually. They don't like to work, and who does? And if you don't work, then you tend to be a bit happier.
Well, there we go. That's the Michael Booth recipe for success. Thank you very much. Let's talk about a breastfeeding controversy.
Different kind of recipe.
Yeah, simpler recipe. What's this all about, Michael?
Yeah, this goes back to a story actually a year or so ago where a cafe in a department store in central Copenhagen, Illum, banned breastfeeding mothers. Now, in Denmark, which is famously progressive about this kind of thing and also about nudity, it's no biggie in Denmark to pop them out and stick a baby on and everyone's happy. But no, this cafe banned.
Thanks for the tips, mothers. By the way. That was the instruction manual for breastfeeding, was it? Just pop them out,
just
stick one on.
If anyone was unclear about the process.
Thanks very much. I've drawn a
that's
diagram.
The correct order. Okay. Yeah, but they banned breastfeeding women, and this went to the equality state's equality board, the Lieberhandlingsnævnet, and they actually said it's okay. You, a restaurateur or cafe owner, can ban breastfeeding mothers. And so there's understandably been a bit of outrage in the Danish media, not least among Danish women's organizations.
Well, from breasts to naked women now, perhaps.
Wow.
That's a good link. A new TV show that perhaps is getting a bit of a controversy around it.
It's all sex, and nudity on the show this morning. Yeah, that's right. A Danish show presented, and also X Factor is recurring here, but it's a judge from X Factor, who's also a jazz drummer, called Thomas Blackman, has caused an international controversy, actually, about a new TV show, which is just coming to the end of its run, I think, in which he and another male friend of often of maturing years and not especially attractive appearance, they sit on a sofa in a darkened studio and look at naked women and discuss the naked women, and the women have to remain mute throughout.
Okay, so what genre of programme is this? Is this a game show? Is this a sort of reality show? Or is it scripted? What is this? Is it a sitcom?
If you ask Mr. Blackman, he believes it's about redressing the imbalance in the poor, beaten-down, emasculated Danish male. We have become a dickless society, he says. I think he means emasculated, but that's his way of saying it. And it's about, just a quote, he wants to revise women's views of men's views of women.
That's pretty complicated. So presumably we can spin it round, and next week there'll be two women sat fully clothed discussing his naked form. We'll have to wait for that one. Michael, thank you very much as ever. Michael Booth is our man in Copenhagen.
And that was Pilgrim There by the Danish songstress Meh.
Very nice. You're listening to... I like that. You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn. 8:51 a.m. here in London. Mr. Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, is here.
Hello.
Hello. You're going to run us through some papers this morning.
I am indeed.
The British papers are laid out attractively in front of you, sort of fanned out in front. And where do you want to start?
Let's start with The Independent, whose headline on the front page is The Lords on Trial. This is the House of Lords, the Second Chamber, and the United Kingdom. It's an unelected chamber. There are the vast majority of them are chosen by political parties. There's also a few bishops in there as well. Mm-hmm. Perhaps not the most democratic of forums, but it has some say over the laws of the land. And there are two things here. One is there's a scandal ongoing at the moment here in the UK about lobbying. At the weekend, it was revealed that three members of the House of Lords had been paid money to lobby on behalf of different organisations. While they're under this pressure, the House of Lords is also considering the gay marriage bill, which passed by a whacking great majority in the House of Commons about 3 or 4 months ago now. But it has to be passed by the House of Lords as well. Normally, the Lords would just pass this, you know, as it was, because it's got such a great majority in House of Commons. But let's say they are slightly more elderly in the House of Lords and slightly more reactionary. So some of the Lords who have made some comments, I think some of these comments are worth reading out in full.
Let's hear them.
Lord Deer is opposed to this because he says, and it's only out of love.
Oh yes.
He says, "I fear the bill, should it become law, could well create such opposition to homosexuals in general that the climate of tolerance and acceptance in this country that we have all championed and supported and seen flourish over the years could well be set back by decades."
Oh come on,
so
dear.
He's looking out. He's looking out for the gays.
Yeah, he is indeed.
Amazingly, sort of backward way he's managed to justify his perspective, isn't it?
Well, you think that's backward. Baroness Knight of Collingtree,
of course,
a Conservative, it says here, although I think you'd probably be able to guess, said, "Of course, homosexuals are very artistic and delightful people too. But marriage is not just about love. It's about a man and a woman created to produce children, producing children. This bill is pretending it can turn men into women or that children do not need a father." Not all of the lords and ladies are like that. Lord Black of Brentwood, who's a gay Tory peer, said, "You know, this is 2013. Gay people don't want to be tolerated in this society. They want to be equal in this society." And he also spoke as well, quite movingly, about, you know, the fact that he wants to get married because he loves his partner. So, it's going to go through, but it's, that's part of it.
But I think it does raise interesting questions, though, about the House of Lords, because in Canada we have an unelected upper house as well, and there have been many calls for Parliament to reform it and change it to an elected body. Has there ever been that sort of reaction here in the UK?
Yes. So when the Labour government came in 1997, Tony Blair said that he wanted to reform the House of Lords and have an elected second chamber. Now, at that time, the House of Lords wasn't just selected. There were also, at the time, I think, sort of 600 or so hereditary peers. Mm. So people who had their position due to who they were the son or daughter of. So there was a big drive to get rid of the hereditary peers. The vast majority of them went in the Labour Party's first term in 1997. But proper elected reform of to create an elected second chamber has failed. There was an attempt, a ludicrous attempt, a few years ago, where they voted for five different options, and none of the five options quite got enough votes, so they just decided to stick with what they had, which no one actually wanted.
It's a fairly torrid and confused tale to the outside eyes, I suspect.
Indeed. It's been going on for a while, and it will, I'm sure, go on again.
Another story that's grabbed your attention is about Latvia. When I was in Latvia for the Northern Future Forum in February, I think it was, I interviewed the president and I asked him about the euro, this very question. You know, there's all this, the euro is in crisis. Why are you so desperate to get in? Mm. And now it looks like it's going to happen.
Yes. So tomorrow, Brussels is likely to recommend that Latvia becomes the 18th country to adopt the euro. And there are some issues here. Latvia, after the crisis in Cyprus, became the next place where a lot of Russian money was deposited. So there are concerns about the size of Russian deposits, because this is Latvia is a small country, just a million or so people. It's got its domestic banking sector is perhaps not as strong as it could be. But Latvia sees it as not just economically a sensible, but also as a security thing to be more involved, more part of Europe. So 2 years ago, we were thinking, are people going to be dropping out of the euro? It looks from January next year as if there will be 18 members, not 17. Should we move on to the Times?
Go on, then.
Okay, so the Times, two big stories, one on the front, one on the back. Let's start with the front. Go ready to replace GCSE with new eye level, as I, as in the letter I,
yes.
not the ear in the eye. Gove is Michael Gove, the Education Secretary. He is trying to reform the British education system. And now here's the thing that's curious. He is a traditionalist.
Yes.
He thinks that coursework is bad and it should be proper exams and that we should, you know, we should be very, very traditional. And yet he wants to replace A, B, C, D, E as a marking system with 1 to 8. So you'd be like, what did you get? I got an 8.
Is that good? Should I be congratulating you, or are you pitying the dunce?
8 is a good. Because they want to then, you know, if need be, go up to 9 if people
of
are getting too many 8s.
And great inflation eventually.
And eventually go up to 11. Very briefly, last 30 seconds, let's just mention the back page story. Mourinho falling in love again. We started with love, we're ending with love. Jose Mourinho, the Portuguese football manager, he was manager of Chelsea many years ago. That's where he sort of really came to the fore. He's gone off to all the other big European clubs. He's coming back to Chelsea, the big sports story of the day here in the UK.
It's a business one as well, isn't it? I mean, it's very big news. And like he's played with this idea of the romance of it. He's actually talked about
he talks about we will marry again.
Yeah, him and Abramovich.
Exactly.
So is this a good marriage?
I think it fizzled out. He's had a couple of other relationships since, but he's been welcomed back to the fold now.
Yeah, so there we are.
Like all good marriages, I guess.
Thanks, Steve.
But unfortunately, Steve, that is all the time we have for today's program. Many thanks to our producers, Barbara Feeney and Annabelle Bly. Our researcher today was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was the very talented Alex Funnel. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. Dom and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds.
Saying goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.